Side 16. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 551. Of all her putative fathers, Max Schlepsik and masked extras on one side of the moving film, Franz Perkler and certainly other pairs of hands busy through trouser cloth that Alpdrücken night on the other, Bianca is closest, this last possible moment below decks here behind the ravening jackal, closest to you, who came in blinding color, slouched alone in your own seat, never threatened along any rookwise row or diagonal all night, you whose interdiction from her mother's water-white love is absolute, you alone, saying, "Sure, I know them," omitted, chuckling, "Count me in," unable, thinking, "Probably some hooker. She favors you most of all. You'll never get to see her, so somebody has to tell you." Halfway up the ladder, Slothrop is startled by a bright set of teeth beaming out of a dark hatchway.
"I was watching. I hope you don't mind."
Seems to be that Nip again who introduces himself now as Ensign Morituri of the Imperial Japanese Navy.
"Yeah, I..."
Why is Slothrop drawling this way?
"So you're watching. Last night, too, mister."
"You think I am a voyeur. Yes, you do, but it isn't that. There is no thrill, I mean. But when I watch people, I feel less alone."
"Well, hell, Ensign. Why don't you just join in? They're always looking for company."
"Oh, my goodness."
Grinning one of them big polyhedral Jap grins like they do.
"Then I would feel more alone."
Tables and chairs have been set out under orange and red stripe awnings on the fantail. Slothrop and Morituri have got the place almost to themselves, except for some girls in two-piece swimsuits out to catch some sun before it goes away. Cumulonimbus are building up dead ahead. You can hear thunder in the distance. The air is coming awake. The steward brings coffee, cream, porridge, and fresh oranges. Slothrop looks at the porridge, doubtful.
"I'll take it," Ensign Morituri, grabbing the bowl.
"Oh, sure."
Slothrop notices now how this Nip also has this wide handlebar mustache.
I'm hep to you. A porridge fan, shameful, a latent Anglophile.
Yeah, you're blushing."
Pointing and hollering, "Ha, ha, ha."
"You found me out, yes, yes. I've been on the wrong side for 6 years."
"Ever try to get away?"
"And find out what you people are really like? Oh, my golly. What if File changes then to Phobe? Where would I be?"
He giggles, spits an orange pit over the side. Seems he put in a few weeks' training on that Formosa in kamikaze school, but they washed him out. No one ever told him why exactly. Something to do with his attitude.
"I just didn't have a good attitude," he sighs. "So they sent me back here again by way of Russia and Switzerland, this time with the propaganda ministry."
He would sit most of the day watching Allied footage for what could be pulled and worked into newsreels to make the Axis look good and the other side look bad.
"All I know about Great Britain comes from that raw material."
"Looks like German movies have warped other outlooks around here, too."
"You mean Margaritas? Did you know that's how we met? A mutual friend at Ufa. I was on holiday at Bad Karma just before the Polish invasion, the little town where you joined us. It was a spa. I watched you fall in the water. Then you climbed the board. I also watched Margarita watching you. Please don't be offended, Slothrop, but it might be better to stay away from her right now."
"Not at all. I know something creepy is going on."
He tells Morituri about the incident in the Sprudelhof and Margarita's flight from the apparition in black. The ensign nods, grim, twisting half his mustache up so it points in a saber at one eye.
"She didn't tell you what happened there? Golly, Jack. You had better know Ensign Morituri's story."
Wars have a way of overriding the days just before them. In the looking back, there is such noise and gravity, but we are conditioned to forget, so that the war may have more importance. Yes, but still, isn't the hidden machinery easier to see in the days leading up to the event? There are arrangements, things to be expedited, and often the edges are apt to lift briefly, and we see things we were not meant to. They'd tried to talk Margarita out of going to Hollywood. She went, and she failed. Rollo was there when she returned to keep the worst from happening. For a month, he impounded sharp objects, kept her at ground level and away from chemicals, which meant she didn't sleep much. She would drop off and wake up hysterical, afraid to go to sleep, afraid she wouldn't know how to get back. Rollo did not have a keen mind. He meant well, but after a month of her, he found he couldn't take any more. Actually, it surprised everyone that he'd lasted so long. Greta was handed over to Sigmund, hardly improved, but perhaps no worse. The trouble with Sigmund was the place he happened to be living in, a drafty, crenellated deformity overlooking a cold little lake in the Bavarian Alps. Parts of it must have dated back to the fall of Rome. That was where Sigmund brought her. She had got the idea somewhere that she was part Jewish. Things in Germany by then, as everyone knows, were very bad. Margarita was terrified of being found out. She heard Gestapo in every puff of air that slipped in, among any of a thousand windways of dilapidation. Sigmund spent whole nights trying to talk it away. He was no better at it than Rollo. It was around this time that her symptoms began. However psychogenic these pains, tics, hives, and nauseas, her suffering was real. Acupuncturists came down by Zeppelin from Berlin, showing up in the middle of the night with little velvet cases full of gold needles. Viennese analysts, Indian holy men, Baptists from America trooped in and out of Sigmund's castle. Stage hypnotists and Colombian curanderos slept on the rug in front of the fireplace. Nothing worked. Sigmund grew alarmed, and before long as ready as Margarita to hallucinate. Probably it was she who suggested bad karma. It had a reputation that summer for its mud, hot and greasy mud with traces of radium, jet black, softly bubbling. Ah, anyone who's been sick in that way can imagine her hope. That mud would cure anything. Where was anybody that summer before the war? Dreaming. The spas that summer, the summer Ensign Morituri came to Bad Karma, were crowded with sleepwalkers. Nothing for him to do at the embassy. They suggested a holiday till September. He should have known something was up, but he only went on holiday to Bad Karma. Spent the days drinking Pilsner Urquelle in the café by the lake in the Pavilion Park. He was a stranger, half the time drunk, silly, beer drunk, and he hardly spoke their language, but what he saw must have been going on all over Germany, a premeditated frenzy. Margarita and Sigmund moved along the same magnolia-shaded paths, sat out in rolling chairs to hear concerts of patriotic music. When it rained, they fidgeted over card games in one of the public rooms of their Kurhaus. At night they watched the fireworks, fountains, spark-foaming rockets, yellow starbursts high over Poland. That oniric season. There was no one in all the spas to read anything in the patterns the fires made. They were only gay lights, nervous as the fantasies that flickered from eye to eye, trailing the skin like the ostrich fans of 50 years ago. When did Sigmund first notice her absences, or when did they become for him more than routine? Always she gave him plausible stories, a medical appointment, a chance meeting with an old friend, drowsiness in the mud baths while time raced by. It may have been unaccustomed sleep that got him suspicious at last because of what her wakefulness had put him through in the South. The stories about the children in the local newspapers could have made no impression, not then. Sigmund only read headlines, and rarely at that, to fill up a dead moment. Morituri saw them often. They would meet and bow, exchange Heil Hitlers, and the ensign would be permitted a few minutes to practice his German. Except for waiters and barmen, they were the only people he spoke with. Out at the tennis courts, waiting in line at the pump room under the cool colonnade, at an aquatic corso, a battle of flowers, a Venetian fete, Sigmund and Margarita hardly changed. He, with his, Morituri thought of it as his American smile around the amber stem of his dead pipe, his head like a flesh Christmas ornament. How long ago it was. She with her yellow sunglasses and garbo hats. The flowers were all that changed about her day to day. Morning glory, almond blossom, foxglove. Morituri grew to look forward so to these daily meetings. His wife and daughters clear on the other side of the world, himself exiled in a country that bewildered and oppressed him. He needed the passing zoo-goer's civility, the guidebook words. He knows he stared back, every bit as curious. In their European slickness, they all fascinated him. The white-plumed old ladies in the lying-out chairs, the veterans of the Great War like serene hippopotamuses soaking in the steel baths, their effeminate secretaries chattering shrill as monkeys across the Sprudelstrasse, while far down the arches of lindens and chestnuts you could hear the endless roar of carbon dioxide at the bubbling spring coming out of solution in great shuddering spheres. But Sigmund and Margarita fascinated him most of all. They seemed as alien here as I was. We each have antennas, don't we, tuned to recognize our own. One forenoon, by accident, he met Sigmund alone, a tweed statue on his walking stick, in front of the inhalatorium, looking as if he'd lost his way, no real place to go, no desire. Without premeditation, then, they began to talk. The time was right. They moved off presently, strolling through the crowds of sick foreigners, while Sigmund told of his troubles with Greta, her Jewish fantasy, her absences. The day before he had caught her out in a lie. He'd come in very late. Her hands had taken a fine tremor that wouldn't stop. He'd begun to notice things, her shoes beaded with mud. A seam in her dress widened, nearly ripped, though she'd been losing weight. But he hadn't the courage to have it out with her. Morituri, who had been reading the papers, for whom the connection had sprung up like a monster from the tales of the Trinkhalle, but who did not have the words, German or otherwise, to tell Sigmund, Morituri, the beer ensign, began to follow her then. She never looked back, but she knew he was there. At the weekly ball in the Kursaal, he felt, for the first time, a reticence among them all. Margarita, eyes he was accustomed to seeing covered with sunglasses, naked now, burning terribly, never took her gaze from him. The Kur orchestra played selections from The Merry Widow and Secrets of Suzanne, out-of-date music, and yet, when bits of it found Morituri years later in the street, over the radio, they never failed to back the unwritten taste of that night, the three of them at the edge of a deepness none could sound. Some last reprise of the European 30s he had never known, which are also for him a particular room, a salon in the afternoon. Lean girls in gowns, mascara all around their eyes, the men with faces shaven very smooth, film star polished. Not operetta, but dance music here, sophisticated, soothing, a bit modern, dipping elegantly in the up-to-date melodic lines. An upstairs room with late sunlight coming in, deep carpets, voices saying nothing heavy or complex, smiles informed and condescending. He was awakened that morning in a soft bed. He looks forward to an evening at a cabaret dancing to popular love songs played in just such a mannered and polished style. His afternoon salon with its held tears, its smoke, its careful passion has been a way station between the comfortable morning and the comfortable night. It was Europe, the smoky, citied fear of death. And most perilous it was Margarita's scrutable eyes, that lost encounter in the Kursaal, black eyes among those huddled jewels and nodding old generals, and the roar from the Brodelbrunnen outside, filling the quiet spaces and the music as machinery was soon to fill the sky. Next evening, Morituri followed her out for the last time, down the worn paths, under the accustomed trees, past the German goldfish pool that reminded him of home, across the golf links, the day's last white-mustached men struggling up out of traps and hazards, their caddies standing at allegorical attention in the glow of the sunset, the bundled clubs in fascist silhouette. Twilight came down on Bad Karma that night, pallid and violent. The horizon was a biblical disaster. Greta had dressed all in black, a hat with a veil covering most of her hair, purse slung by a long strap over one shoulder. As choices of a destination narrowed to, as Morituri ran into snares, the night began to lay out for him. Prophecy filled him like the river wind. Where she had been on her absences, how the children in those headlines had... They had arrived at the edge of the black mud pool. That underground presence, old as earth, partly enclosed back at the spa, and a name given to. The offering was to be a boy, lingering after all the others had gone. His hair was cold snow. Morituri could only hear fragments of what they said. The boy wasn't afraid of her at first. He might not have recognized her from his dreams. It would have been his only hope. But they had made that impossible, his German overseers. Morituri stood by in his uniform, waiting, unbuttoning the jacket so that he could move, though he didn't want to. Certainly they were all repeating this broken act from an earlier time. Her voice began its rise, and the boy his trembling. "You have been in exile too long." It was a loud clap in the dusk. "Come home with me," she cried. "Back to your people." Now he was trying to break away, but her hand, her gloved hand, her claw had flown out and seized his arm. "Little piece of Jewish shit, don't try to run away from me."
"No."
But at the very end, rising in a provocative question, "You know who I am. My home is the form of light," burlesquing it now in heavy Yiddish dialect, actressy and false.
"I wander all the diaspora looking for stray children. I am Israel. I am the Shekhinah, queen, daughter, bride, and mother of God, and I will take you back, you fragment of smashed vessel, even if I must pull you by your knee, little circumcised penis. No."
So Ensign Morituri committed then the only known act of heroism in his career. It's not even in his folder. She had gathered the boy, struggling, one glove busy between his legs. Morituri rushed forward. For a moment, the three of them swayed, locked together. Gray night statuary. Its name may have been the family. Stillness. No, they moved. Immortality was not the issue. That's what made them different. No survival, beyond the senses taking of it. No handing down. Doomed as D'Annunzio's adventure at Fiume, as the Reich itself, as the poor creatures from whom the boy now tore loose and ran off into the evening. Margarita collapsed by the edge of the great lightless pool. Morituri knelt beside her wide. It was terrible. What had brought him there, what had understood and moved in so automatically, fell back now to sleep. His conditioning, his verbal, ranked and uniformed self took over again. He knelt, shivering, more afraid than he'd ever been in his life. It was she who led their way back to the spa. She and Sigmund left Bad Karma that night. The boy may have been too frightened, the light too faint. Morituri himself may have had strong protectors, for God knows he was visible enough there, but no police came. It never occurred to me to go to them. In my heart I knew she had murdered. You may condemn me for it, but I saw what I'd be handing her over to. Came to the same thing, in official custody or not, you see. The next day was 1 September. There was no longer any way for children to vanish mysteriously. The forenoon has gone dark. Rain spits in under the awning. The bowl of porridge has stayed all untouched in front of Morituri. Sothrop is sweating, staring at the bright remains of an orange. "Listen," it has occurred to his agile brain. "What about Bianca, then? Is she, you think?" Frisking his great mustache. "What do you mean? Are you asking, can she be saved?" "Oh, pip-pip, old Jap, come off it. Look, what can you save her from?" His eyes are prying Slothrop away from his comfort. Rain is drumming now on the awnings, spilling in clear lacework from the edges. "But wait a minute. Oh, shit, that woman yesterday, in that Sprudelhof. Yes, remember, Greta also saw you coming up out of the river. Now think of the folklore among these people about radioactivity, these travelers from spa to spa, season after season. It's grace. It's the holy waters of Lourdes. This mysterious radiation that can cure so much. Might it be the ultimate cure?" I watched her face as you came aboard. I was with her at the edge of one radioactive night. I know what she saw this time. One of those children.
Preserved, nourished by the mud, the radium, growing taller and stronger while slowly, viscous and slow, the currents bore him along underground, year by year, until at last, grown to manhood, he came to the river, came up out of the black radiance of herself to find her again, Shekhinah, bride, queen, daughter, and mother, motherly as sheltering mud and glowing pitchblende. Almost directly overhead, thunder suddenly breaks in a blinding egg of sound. Somewhere inside the blast, Slothrop has murmured, "Quit fooling." "Are you going to risk finding out?" "Who is this? Oh, sure, it's a Jap ensign looking at me like this, but where are Bianca's arms, her defenseless mouth?" "Well, in a day or two, we'll be in Swinemünde, right? Talking to keep from..." "Get up from the table, then, you asshole."
We'll just keep moving, that's all. In the end, it doesn't matter.
Look, you've got kids. How can you say that? Is that all you want, just to keep moving?
I want to see the war over in the Pacific so that I can go home.
Since you ask.
It's the season of the plum rains now, the Bayou, when all the plums are ripening. I want only to be with Michiko and our girls, and once I'm there, never to leave Hiroshima again. I think you'd like it there, Itsushu, on the inland sea. Very pretty. A perfect size, big enough for city excitement, small enough for the serenity a man needs. But these people are not returning. They are leaving their homes, you see.
But one of the knots, securing the rain-heavy awning to its frame, has given way, white small stuff unlacing rapidly, whipping around in the rain. The awning sags, funneling rainwater at Slothrop and Moratori, and they flee below decks. They get separated in a crowd of newly risen roisterers. There is hardly a thing now in Slothrop's head but getting to Bianca. At the end of the passageway, across a score of empty faces, he spots Stefania in white cardigan and slacks, beckoning. It takes him 5 minutes to thread his way to her, by which time he's picked up a Brandy Alexander, a party hat, a sign taped to his back urging whoever reads it in low Pomeranian to kick Slothrop, lipstick smudges in 3 shades of magenta, and a black Italian Maduro someone has thoughtfully already lit.
"You may look like the soul of conviviality," Stefania greets him, "but it doesn't fool me. Under that cheerful mask is the face of a Jonah."
"You mean,
I mean Margarita. She's locked herself in the head, hysterical. Nobody can bring her out."
"So you're looking at me. How about Tanats?"
"Tanats has disappeared, and so has Bianca."
"Oh, shit. Margarita thinks you've done away with her."
"Not me."
He gives her a quick rundown of Ensign Moratori's tale. Some of her elan, her resilience, go away. She bites a fingernail.
"Yes, there were rumors. Sigmund, before he vanished, leaked just enough to titillate people, but never got specific. That was his style. Listen, Slothrop, do you think Bianca's in any danger?"
"I'll try to find out." He is interrupted here by a swift kick in the ass.
"Unlucky you," crows a voice behind them. "I'm the only one on board who reads low Pomeranian."
"Unlucky you," thuds.
"All I wanted was a free ride to Swinemünde.
But like Stefania says, there's only one free ride. Meantime, start working off the fare for this one. Go see Margarita."
"You want me to? Come on.
We don't want anything to happen."
"One of the general orders aboard this vessel. Nothing shall happen." Well, Slothrop politely sticks the rest of his cigar between Madame Protsalovska's teeth and leaves her puffing on it, fists jammed in her sweater pockets. Bianca isn't in the engine room. He moves around in pulsing bulb light, among asbestos-packed masses, burning himself once or twice where insulation's missing, looking into pale recesses, shadows, wondering about his own insulation here. Nothing but machinery, noise. He heads for the ladder. A scrap of red is waiting for him. No, only her frock, with a damp trace of his own semen still at the hem. This loud humidity has kept it there. He crouches, holding the garment, smelling her smell. "I'm a child. I know how to hide, and I can hide you. Bianca," he calls. "Bianca, come out." Gathered about the door to the head, he finds an assortment of upper-class layabouts and drunks blocking the passageway along with a litter of bottles and glassware, and a seated circle of cocaine habitués, crystal birds flying up into forests of nose hair off the point of a gold and ruby dagger. Slothra pushes through, leans on the door, and calls Margarita's name.
"Go away."
"You don't have to come out. Just let me in."
"I know who you are."
"Please.
They were very clever sending you as poor Max, but it won't work now."
"I'm through with them. I swear it. I need you, Greta."
"Bullshit. For what?" "They'll kill you then. Go away."
"I know where Bianca is."
"What have you done with her?"
"Just will you let me in?"
After a full minute's silence, she does. A fun-seeker or two tries to push in, but he slams the door and locks it again. Greta is wearing nothing but a black chemise. Strokes of black hair curl high on her thighs. Her face is white, old, strained.
"Where is she?"
"Hiding."
"From me?"
"From them." A quick look at him. Too many mirrors, razors, scissors, lights, too white.
"But you're one of them."
"Quit it. You know I'm not."
"You are. You came up out of the river."
"Well, that's 'cause I fell in, Greta."
"Then they made you."
He watches her playing, nervous with strands of her hair. The Anubis has begun to rock some, but the sickness rising in him is for his head, not his stomach. As she begins to talk, nausea begins to fill him, a glowing black mudslide of nausea. It was always easy for men to come and tell her who to be. Other girls of her generation grew up asking, "Who am I?" For them it was a question full of pain and struggle. For Gretel it was hardly even a question. She had more identities than she knew what to do with. Some of these Gretels have been only the sketchiest of surfaces. Others are deeper. Many have incredible gifts, anti-gravity, dreams of prophecy. Chromatic images surround their faces, glowing in the air. The light itself is actually crying tears, weeping in this stylized way as she is borne along through the mechanical cities. The meteorite walls draped in midair, every hollow and socket empty as a bone, and the failing shadow that shines black all around it, or is held in staring postures, long gowns, fringe and alchemical symbol, veils flowing from leather skullcaps padded concentric as a bike racer's helmet, with crackling tower and obsidian helix, with drive belts and rollers, with strange airship passages that thread underneath arches solemnly past louvers and giant fins in the city mist. In Weiße Sandwiste von New Mexico, she played a cowgirl. First thing they'd asked, "Can you ride?" "Of course," she'd answered. Never been closer than roadside ditches in time of war to any horse in her life, but she needed the work. When the moment came to saddle up, it never occurred to her to be afraid of the beast pressing up between her thighs. It was an American horse named Snake. Trained or not, it could have run away with her, even killed her, but they pranced the screen full of the Sagittarian fire, Gretel and that colt, and her smile never drew back. Here is one of the veils she has shed. A thin white scum, a caustic residue from one recent night in Berlin. "While you were asleep, I left the house. I went out in the street, without my shoes. I found a corpse, a man, a week's gray beard and old gray suit." It was lying still and very white behind a wall. She lay down beside it and put her arms around it. There was frost. The body rolled toward her, and the wrinkles stayed frozen in the cloth. She felt its bristled face rub her own cheek. The smell was no worse than cold meat from the icebox. She lay holding it till morning. "Tell me how it is in your land. What woke her?" Boots in the street, an early steam shovel. She can hardly hear her tired whispering. "Corpse, we live very far beneath the black mud. Days of traveling." Though she couldn't move its limbs easily as a doll's, she could make it say and think exactly what she wished. For an instant, too, she did wonder, not quite in words, if that's how her own soft mind might feel under the fingers of those who... It's snug down here. Now and then you can pick up something from them, a distant rumbling, the implied silhouette of some explosion conducted here through the earth overhead. But nothing ever... too close. It's so dark that things glow. We have flight. There's no sex, but there are fantasies. Even many of those we used to attach to sex, that we once modulated its energy with. As the dizzy debutante Lotte Lustig, she found herself during a flood disguised as a scrubwoman proceeding downriver in a bathtub with rich playboy Max Schlepsig, every girl's dream. Name of the movie was Jugend herauf, a lighthearted pun, of course, on the then popular phrase Juden heraus. Actually, all the bathtub scenes were process shots. She never did get to go out on the river in the bathtub with Max. All that was done with doubles, and in the final print it survived only as a very murky long shot. The figures are darkened and deformed, resembling apes, and the quality of the light is peculiar, as if the whole scene were engraved on dark metal such as lead. Greta's double was actually an Italian stuntman named Blazzo in a long blonde wig. They carried on a romance for a while, but Greta wouldn't go to bed with him unless he wore that wig. Out on the river the rain lashes. The rapids can now be heard approaching, still impossible to see, but real and inevitable. And the doubles both experience an odd ticklish fear now that perhaps they are really lost and that there is really no camera on shore behind the fine gray scribbling of willows, all the crew, sound men, grips, gaffers have left, or never even arrived. And what was that the currents just brought to knock against our snow-white cockle-shell? And what was that thud, so stiffened and so mute?
Bianca is usually silver, or of no color at all. Thousands of times taken, strained through glass, warped in and out the violet-bleeding interfaces of double and triple protars, Schneider angulons, Voigtländer collinears, Steinheil orthostigmats, the Gundlach-Turner Reichs of 1895. For Greta it is her daughter's soul each time, an inexhaustible soul. This scarf of an only child, tucked in waist-high, always out vulnerable to the wind. To call her an extension of her mother's ego is, of course, to invite the bitterest sarcasm, but it's possible, now and then, for Greta to see Bianca in other children, ghostly as a double exposure. Clearly, yes, very clearly in Gottfried, the young pet and protégé of Captain Blissero.
Pull down my straps for a moment. Is it dark enough? Look, Thanat said they were luminous, that he knew each one by heart. They're very white today, aren't they? Long and white like cobwebs. They're on my ass, too, around the insides of my thighs.
Many times afterward, after the blood had stopped and he had put on the alcohol, Thanats would sit with her lying across his knees and read the scars down her back as a gypsy reads a palm. Life scar, heart scar, quoi mystique. What fortunes and fantasies. He was so exalted after the whippings, so taken away by the idea that they would win out, escape. He'd fall asleep before the wildness and hope had quite left him. She loved him most at those moments, just before sleep, her own dorsal side aflame, his little head heavy on her breast, while scar tissue formed silently on her, cell by cell, in the night. She felt almost safe. Each time the lash struck, each attack, in her helplessness to escape, there would come to her a single vision, only one, for each peak of pain. The eye at the top of the pyramid. The sacrificial city, with figures in rust-colored robes. The dark woman waiting at the end of the street. The hooded face of sorrowing Denmark leaning out over Germany. The cherry-red coals falling through the night. Bianca, in a Spanish dancer's costume, stroking the barrel of a gun. Out by one rocket site in the pine woods, Thanat and Gretel found an old road that no one used anymore. Pieces of pavement were visible here and there among the green underbrush. It seemed that if they followed the road, they would come to a town, a station, or outpost. It wasn't at all clear what they would find, but the place would be long deserted. They held hands. Thanat wore an old jacket of green suede with patches on the sleeves. Gretel wore her camel's hair coat and a white kerchief. In places, pine needles were drifted across the old roadway so deep as to silence their footsteps. They came to a slide where years ago the road had been washed away. Gravel spilled salt and pepper downhill toward a river they heard but couldn't see. An old automobile, a Hanomag Storm, hung there, nose down, one door smashed open. The lavender-gray metal shell had been picked clean as the skeleton of a deer. Somewhere in these woods was the presence that had done this. They skirted the wreck, afraid to come too near the spidered glass, the hard mortality in the shadows of the front seat. Remains of houses could be glimpsed back in the trees. There was now a retreat of the light, though it was still before noon, and the forest grew no thicker here. In the middle of the road, giant turds showed up, fresh, laid in twists like strands of rope, dark and knotted. What could have left them? At the same instant, she and Thanats both realized that for hours now they must have been walking through the ruin of a great city, not an ancient ruin, but brought down inside their lifetime. Ahead of them, the path curved on into trees. But something stood now between them and whatever lay around the curve, invisible, impalpable, some monitor saying, "Not one step farther. That's all. Not one. Go back now." It was impossible to move any farther into it. They were both terrified. They turned, feeling it at their backs, and moved away quickly. Back at the Schussstelle, they found Bucero in his final madness. The trunks in the cold little clearing were stripped of bark, bleeding with beads of gum from the rocket blasts.
He could have banished us. Bucero was a local deity. He wouldn't even have needed a piece of paper, but he wanted us all to stay. He gave us the best there was. Beds, food, liquor, drugs. Something was being planned. It involved the boy, Gottfried. That was as unmistakable as the smell of resin, first thing those blue hazy mornings. But Bucero would tell us nothing. We moved into the heath. There were oil fields and blackened earth. Yabos flew over in diamond shapes, hunting us. Bucero had grown on into another animal, a werewolf. But with no humanity left in its eyes, that had faded out day after day and been replaced by gray furrows, red veins, and patterns that weren't human. Islands, clotted islands in the sea. Sometimes even the topographic lines nested on a common point. It is the map of my Urheimat. Imagine a shriek so quiet it's almost a whisper. The kingdom of Lord Bucero, a land. I had a sudden understanding. He was seeing the world now in mythical regions. They had their maps, real mountains, rivers, and colors. It was not Germany he moved through. It was his own space. But he was taking us along with him. My cunt swelled with blood at the danger, the chances for our annihilation. Delicious, never knowing when it would come down, because the space and time were Bucero's own. He did not fall back along roads. He did not cross bridges or lowlands. We sailed Lower Saxony, island to island. Each firing site was another island in a white sea. Each island had its peak in the center. Was it the position of the rocket itself? The moment of liftoff? A German odyssey? Which one would be the last? The home island? I keep forgetting to ask Tanatz whatever became of Gottfried. Tanatz was allowed to stay with the battery, but I was taken away, driven in a Hispano-Suiza with Bucero himself, out through the gray weather to a petrochemical plant that for days had stalked us in a wheel at our horizon, black and broken towers in the distance, clustered together, a flame that always burned at the top of one stack. It was the castle. Bucero looked over, about to speak, and I said, "The castle." The mouth smiled, quick absent. The wrinkled wolf eyes had gone even beyond these domestic moments of telepathy, on into its animal north, to a persistence on the hard edge of death I can't imagine. Tough cells with possible flicker inside, running on nothing but ice, or less. He called me Katya. "You'll see that your little trick won't work again, not now, Katya." I wasn't frightened. It was madness I could understand, or else the hallucinating of the very old. The silver stork flew wings down into our wind, brow low and legs back, Prussian occipital knot behind. On its shiny surfaces now appeared black swirls of limousines and staff cars in the driveway of the main office. I saw a light plane, a two-seater, at the edge of the parking lot. The faces of the men inside seemed familiar. I knew them from films. The power and the gravity were there. They were important men, but I only recognized one, Generaldirektor Smaragd, from Leverkusen, an elderly man who used a cane, a notorious spiritualist before the war, and it seemed even now. "Greta," he smiled, groping for my hand. "Ah, we're all here." But his charm was shared by none of the others. They'd all been waiting for Bucero, a meeting of nobles in the castle. They went into the boardroom. I was left with an assistant named Drone, high forehead, graying hair, always fussing with his necktie. He'd seen every one of my films. We moved off into the machinery. Through the windows of the boardroom, I saw them at a round French table with something in the center. It was gray, plastic, shining, light moving on its surfaces. "What is it?" I asked, vamping Drone. He took me out of earshot of the others. "I think it's for the F-Gerät," he whispered. "F?" says Slothrop. "F-Gerät, you sure of that?" "Some letter." "S." "All right, S. They are children at the threshold of language with these words they make up. It looked to me like an ectoplasm, something they had forced by their joint will to materialize on the table. No one's lips were moving. It was a seance. I understood then that Bucero had brought me across a frontier, had injected me at last into his natives without a tremor of pain. I was free. Men crowded behind me in the corridor, blocking the way back. Drona's hand was sweating on my sleeve. He was a plastics connoisseur. Flipping his fingernail against a large, clear African mask, cocking his ear, "Can you hear it? The true ring of polystyrene." And going into raptures for me over a heavy chalice of methylmethacrylate, a replica ale. We were by a tower reactor. A strong paint thinner smell was in the air. Clear rods of some plastic came hissing out through an extruder at the bottom of the tower into cooling channels or into a chopper. The heat was heavy in the room. I thought of something very deep, black and viscous, feeding this factory. From outside I heard motors. Were they all leaving? Why was I here? Plastic serpents crawled endlessly to left and right. Chins of my escort tried to crawl out the openings in their clothes. I could do whatever I wanted. Black, radiant, and deep, I knelt and began unbuttoning Drona's trousers, but two others took me by the arms and dragged me off into a warehouse area. Others followed or entered from other doors. Great curtains of styrene or vinyl in all colors, opaque and transparent, hung row after row from overhead. They flared like the northern lights. I felt that there was an audience waiting to begin. Drona and the men stretched me out on an inflatable plastic mattress. All around I watched a clear crumb air or of the light said butadiene, and I heard beauty dying. Plastic rustled and snapped around us, clothes in ghost white. They took away my clothes and dressed an exotic costume of summer, very tight at the waist, open at the crotch. It felt alive on me. "Forget leather, forget satin," shivered Drona. "Rolex, the material of the future." I can't describe its perfume or how it felt. The luxury, the moment it touched, brought my nipples up, swollen and begging to be bitten. I wanted to feel it against my cunt. Never war, before or since, aroused me quite as much as Imipolex. They promised me brassieres, chemises, stockings, gowns of the same material. Drona had strapped on a gigantic Imipolex penis over his own. I rubbed my face against it. It was so delicious. An abyss between my feet. Things, memories, no way to distinguish them anymore, went tumbling downward through my head. A torrent. I was evacuating all these out into some void. From my vertex, curling, bright-colored hallucinations went streaming. Baubles, amusing lines of dialogue, objets d'art. I was letting them all go. Holding none. Was this submission, then? Letting all these go? I don't know how long they kept me there. I slept. I woke. Men appeared and vanished. Time had lost meaning. One morning I was outside the factory, naked in the rain. Nothing grew. Something had been deposited in a great fan that went on for miles. Some tarry kind of waste. I had to walk all the way back to the firing site. They were all gone. Thanat had left a note asking me to try to get to Swinemünde. It must have happened at the site. There was a silence in that clearing once before, once in next year I was in America. Very deep in the jungle, we came on a flight of stone steps covered with vines, fungus, centuries of decay. The others climbed to the top, but I couldn't. It was the same as the day with Thanats in the pine forest. I felt a silence waiting for me up there, not for them, but for me alone. My own personal silence. Up on the bridge, as the storm paused loud in the glass, great weathers falling at random, night, whap, the living shibble just for the rainbow edge of the sound. It takes a certain kind of maniac, at least a Polish cavalry officer, to stand in this pose behind such brittle, thin separation, and stare each blow full in its muscularity. Behind Protsalovsky, the clinometer bob goes to and fro with his ships rolling, a pendulum in a dream. Stormlight has turned the line black, black as his eyes, black cap cocked so tough and steely aslant the furrows of his forehead. Light clusters clear deep on the face of the radio gear, fans up softly off the dial of the Pylorus, spills out portals onto the White River. Inexplicably, the afternoon has been going on for longer than it should. Daylight has been declining for too many hours. Corpuscents have begun to flicker now in the rigging. The storm yanks at rope and cable. The cloudy night goes white and loud in hues. Protalovsky smokes a cigar and studies charts of the Oderhaf. All this light, and lookouts watching from shore. Is this arm of the passage being kept in grease pencil X by beautiful X across some field of Russian plastic, inside where cobwebs whiten the German windows nobody needs to stand at,
where phosphor grass ripples across the A-scopes, and the play you feel through the hand crank in the invisible teeth is the difference between hit and miss. Vaslav, is the pip you see there even a ship? In the zone, in these days there's simulation. Standing waved in the water, large drone birds, so well known as to have nicknames among the operators. Wayward balloons, flotsam from other theaters of war, Brazilian oil drums, whiskey cases stenciled for Fort Lamy. Observers from other galaxies, episodes of smoke, moments of high albedo. Your real targets are hard to come by. Too much fusion out here for most replacements and late draftees. Only the older scope hands can still maintain a sense of the over the watches of their durations, jittering electric green for what must have seemed at first forever. They have come to understand distribution, learned a visual mercy. How probable is the Anubis in this estuary tonight? Its schedule has lapsed, fashionably, unavoidably. It should have been through Svinemünde weeks ago, but the Vistula was under Soviet interdiction to the white ship. The Russians even had a guard posted on board for a while. The Anubian ladies vamped them off long enough to single up all lines, and so the last reprise of Polish homeland was on, across these water meadows of the north. Radio messages following them in, clear one day and code an early and shapeless situation dithering between executioner's silence and the big time. There are reasons for an Anubis affair right now, and also reasons against, and the arguments go on, too remote to gather, and orders are changed hour to hour. Pitching and rolling furiously, the Anubis drives northward. Lightning flickers all around the horizon, and thunder that reminds the military men on board of drum fire announcing battles they're not sure now if they survived or still dream, wake up into and die. Weather decks shine slick and bare. Party litter clogs the drains. Stale fat smoke goes oozing out the galley portal into the rain. The saloon's been set up for baccarat, and filthy movies are showing in the boiler room. The second dog watch is about to come on. The watch settles like the soul of a kerosene lamp just lit into its evening routine. Partygoers stagger fore and aft, evening clothes decorated with sunbursts of vomit. Ladies lie out in the rain, nipples erect and heaving under drenched silk. Stewards skid along the decks with salvers of Dramamine and bicarbonate. Barfing aristocracy sag all down the lifelines. Here comes Slothrop now down a ladder to the main deck, bounced by the rolling off of alternate man ropes, feeling none too keen. He's lost Bianca. Gone fussing through the ship, doubling back again and again, can't find her any more than his reason for leaving her this morning. It matters, now that Margarita has wept to him across the stringless lyre and bitter chasm of a ship's toilet, of her last days with Blissero, he knows as well as he has to that it's the Escarette, after all, that's following him. It and the pale plastic Oslo Yampf. That if he's been seeker and sought, well, he's also baited and bait. The Imipolex question was planted for him by somebody back at the Casino Hermann Göring, with hopes it would flower into a full imipolektik with its own potency in the zone. He knew Slothrop would jump for it. Looks like there are sub-Slothrop needs they know about, and he doesn't. This is humiliating on the face of it, but now there's also the even more annoying question, what do I need that badly? Even a month ago, given a day or two of peace, he might have found his way back to the September afternoon, to the stiff cock in his pants, sprung fine as a dowser's wand, trying to point up at what was hanging there in the sky for everybody. Dowsing rockets is a gift, and he had it, suffered from it, trying to fill his body to the pores and follicles with prurience, to enter, to be filled, to go hunting after, to be shown, to begin to scream, to open arms, legs, mouth, asshole, eyes, nostrils, without a hope of mercy to its intention, waiting in the sky paler than dim commercial Jesus. But nowadays, some kind of space he cannot go against has opened behind Slothrop. Bridges that might have led back are down now for good. He is growing less anxious about betraying those who trust him. He feels obligations less immediately. There is, in fact, a general loss of emotion, a numbness he ought to be alarmed at, but can't quite... can't. Russian transmissions come crackling out of ship's radio, and the static blows like sheets of rain. Lights have begun to appear on shore. Pertolovsky throws a master switch and cuts off all the lights of the Anubis. St. Elmo's fire will be seen spurting at moments from cross ends, from sharp points, fluttering white as telltales about the antennas and stays. The white ship, camouflaged in the storm, will slip by Stettin's great ruin in silence. Rain will slacken for a moment to port and reveal a few last broken derricks and charred warehouses, so wet and gleaming you can almost smell them, and the beginning of marshland you can smell where no one lives. And then the shore again will be invisible as the open seas. The Oder Hof will grow wider around the Anubis. No patrol boats will be out tonight. White caps will come slamming in out of the darkness and break high over the bow, and brine stream from the golden jackal mouth. Count Vafna lurch aft in nothing but his white bow tie, hands full of red, white, and blue chips that spill and clatter on deck, and he'll never cash them in. The Countess Bibescu, dreaming by the forecastle of Bucharest 4 years ago. The January terror, the Iron Guard on the radio screaming, "Long live death!" And the bodies of Jews and leftists hung on the hooks of the city slaughterhouses, dripping on the boards, smelling of meat and hide, having her breasts sucked by a boy of 6 or 7 in a velvet Fauntleroy suit. Their wet hair flowing together, indistinguishable as their moans now, will vanish inside, sudden whiteness exploding over the bow, and stockings ladder, and silk frocks over rayon slips make swarming moirés. Ardons go limp without warning. Bone buttons shake in terror. Lights be thrown on again, and the deck become a blinding mirror, and not too long after this Slothrop will think he sees her, think he has found Bianca again, dark eyelashes plastered shut and face running with rain. He will see her lose her footing on the slimy deck, just as the Anubis starts a hard roll to port, and even at this stage of things, even in his distance, he will lunge after her without thinking much, slip himself as she vanishes under the chalky lifelines and gone, stagger trying to get back, but be hit too soon in the kidneys, and be flipped that easy over the side, and it's adios to the Anubis and all its screaming fascist cargo, already no more ship, not even black sky, as the rain drives down his falling eyes now in quick needle strokes, and he hits without a call for help, just a meek, tearful, "Oh, fuck," hears it will add nothing to the whipped white desolation that passes for the Oder Hof tonight. The voices are German. Looks like a fishing smack here, stripped for some reason of nets and booms. Cargo piled on deck. A pink-faced youth is peering down at Slothrop from midships, rocking in, rearing back. "He's wearing evening clothes," calling into the pilot house. "Is that good or bad? You're not with the military limit, are you?" "Jesus, kid, I'm drowning. I'll sign a form if you want." Well, that's howdy, partner, in German. The youth reaches out a pink hand whose palm is crusted with barnacles and hauls him on up. Ears freezing, salty snot pouring out his nose, flopping onto a wood deck that reeks with generations of fish, and is scarred bright from more solid cargo. The boat gets underway again with this tremendous surge of acceleration. Slothrop is sent rolling wetly aft. Behind them a great rooster tail foams erect against the rain. Maniacal laughter blows aft from the pilot house. "Hey, who or what is in command of this vessel here?"
"My mother."
The pink boy crouching beside him with an apologetic and helpless look.
"The terror of the high seas."
This apple-cheeked lady is Frau Knapp, and her kid's name is Otto. When she's feeling affectionate, she calls him the silent Otto, which she thinks is very funny, but it dates her. While Slothrop gets out of the tuxedo and hangs it up inside to dry, wrapping himself in an old army blanket, mother and son tell him how they run black market items all along the Baltic coast. Who else would be out tonight during a storm? He has a trustworthy face, Slothrop does. People will tell him anything. Right now, seems they're headed for Swinemünde to take on cargo for a run tomorrow up the coast of Usedom. "Do you know a man in a white suit?" quoting gaily, tripping from a few eras back, "who's supposed to be on the strand promenade in that Swinemünde every day around noon?" Frau Knapp takes a pinch of snuff and beams.
"Everybody does. He's the white knight of the black market, as I am queen of the coastal trade."
"You're Springer, right?"
"Nobody else?"
"Nobody else." Up in his pants pocket, Slothrop is still packing around the chess piece, old Zoira Boomer gave him. By it shall Springer know him. Strothrop falls asleep in the pilot house, gets in 2 or 3 hours, during which Bianca comes to snuggle in under his blanket with him. You're really in that Europe now, she grins, hugging him. Oh, my goodness, Strothrop keeps saying, his voice exactly like Shirley Temple's, out of his control. It sure is embarrassing. He wakes to sunlight, gulls squealing, smell of number 2 fuel oil, the booming of wine barrels down racketing planks to shore. They are docked in Swinemünde by the sagging long ash remains of warehouses. Frau Knopp is supervising some offloading. Otto has a tin can of honest-to-God Bohnenkaffee simmering. First I've had in a while, Slothrop scorching his mouth. Black market, purrs the silent Otto. Good business to be in. I was in it for a while. Oh, yes, and he's left the last of that Bodine hashish, hasn't he? Several fucking ounces, in fact, back on the Anubis. Wasn't that clever? See the sugar bowl do the Tootsie Roll with the big bad devil's food cake. Nice morning, Otto remarks. Slothrop puts his tux back on, wrinkled and shrunken and almost dry, and debarks with Otto to find Der Springer. It seems to be Springer who's chartered today's trip up the coast. Slothrop keeps looking around for the Anubis, but she's nowhere in sight. In the distances, gantries huddle together, skeletal, presiding over the waste that came upon this port so sudden. The Russian assault in the spring has complicated the layout here. The white ship could be hiding behind any of these heaps of dockyard wreckage. Come out, come out. The storm has blown away. The breeze is mild today, and the sky lies overhead in a perfect interference pattern, mackerel gray and blue. Someplace military machines are rooting and clanking. Men and women are hollering near and far in Russian. Otto and Slothrop dodge them down alleys flanked by the remains of half-timbered houses, stepped out story by story, about to meet overhead after centuries of imperceptible toppling. Men in black-billed caps sit on stoops, watching hands for cigarettes. In a little square, market stalls are set up, wood frames and old stained canvas shimmering when the breeze passes through. Russian soldiers lean against posts, talking to girls in dirndls and white knee socks, all nearly still as statues. Market wagons stand unhitched, with tongues tilted to the ground and floors covered with burlap and straw and traces of produce. Dogs sniff among the mud negatives of tank treads. 2 men in dark old blue uniforms work their way along with hose and broom, cleaning away garbage and stone dust with salt water pumped up from the harbor. 2 little girls chase round and round a gaudy red kiosk plastered with chromos of Stalin. Workers in leather caps, blinking, morning-faced, pedal down to the docks with lunchboxes slung on handlebars. Pigeons and seagulls faint for scraps in the gutters. Women with empty string bags hurry by light as ghosts. A lone sapling in the street sings with a blockful of birds you can't see. Just as gaily said, out on the steel-littered promenade, kicking stones, watching the water, eyes idly combing the beach for the odd watch or gold eyeglass frame, waiting for whoever will show up, is the man. About 50, bleak and neutral-colored eyes, hair thick at the sides of his head and brushed back. Slothrop flashes the plastic knight. Der Springer smile bows. Gerhard von Gerl, at your service. They shake hands, though Slothrop's is prickling in an unpleasant way. Gulls cry, waves flatten on the strand. Slothrop says, I have this kind of trick here. You'll have to... You say, Gerhard von what now? This mackerel sky has begun to look less like a moiré and more like a chessboard. I guess we have a friend in common. Well, that Margarita Erdmann saw her last night, yep. She's supposed to be dead. He takes Slothrop's arm, and they all begin to stroll along the promenade. Well, you're supposed to be a movie director. Same thing. Lighting American cigarettes for everybody. Same problems of control, but more intense. As to some musical ears, dissonance is really a higher form of consonance. You've heard about Anton Webern. Very sad. It was a mistake. He was innocent. Ha, of course he was. But mistakes are part of it, too. Everything fits. One sees how it fits, yeah? learns patterns, adjusts to rhythms. One day you are no longer an actor, but free now, over on the other side of the camera. No dramatic call to the front office, just waking up one day and knowing that queen, bishop, and king are only splendid cripples and pawns. Even those that reach the final row are condemned to creep in two dimensions, and no tower will ever rise or descend. No, flight has been given only to the Springer.
Right, Springer, says Otto.
Four Russian privates come wandering out of a bank of ruined hotel fronts, laughing across the promenade, over the wall, down to the water, where they stand throwing smooth stones, kicking waves, singing to each other. Not much of a liberty town, Swinemünde, Slothrop, Fils, von Gerlin, and Margarita, trying not to get personal, but some of his anxiety over Bianca must be coming through. Von Gerlin shakes his arm, a kindly uncle. There now, I wouldn't worry. Bianca's a clever child, and her mother is hardly a destroying goddess. You're a comfort, Springer. The Baltic, restless Wehrmacht gray, whispers along the beach. Van Girl tips an invisible Tyrolean to old ladies in black who've come out in pairs to get some sun. Otto goes chasing seagulls, hands out in front of him, silent movie style, looking to strangle but always missing his bird. Presently they are joined by a party with a lumpy nose, stoop weeks' growth of orange and gray whiskers, and oversized leather trench coat with no trousers on underneath. His name is Nerisch, the same Klaus Nerisch that aerodynamics man Horst Achtfaden fingered for the Schwarzkommando, the very same. He is carrying by the neck an unplucked, dead turkey. As they thread their way among chunks, big and little, of Swinemünde and the battle for it last spring, townspeople begin to appear out of the ruins and to straggle close on Van Girl's landward flank, all eyeing this dead bird. Springer reaches inside his white suit jacket, comes out with a U.S. Army 45, and makes a casual show of checking its action. His following promptly dwindles by a half. "They're hungrier today," observes Nerisch. "True," replies the Springer, "but today there are fewer of them." "Wow," it occurs to Slothrop. "That's a shitty thing to say." Springer shrugs. "Be compassionate, but don't make up fantasies about them. Despise me, exalt them, but remember we define each other. Elite and preterite. We move through a cosmic design of darkness and light. And in all humility, I am one of the very few who can comprehend it in toto. Consider honestly, therefore, young man, which side you would rather be on. While they suffer in perpetual shadows, it's always bright days, Foxtrot. Bright days for the black market. That silver and gold makes it shine. From the coral sea to the sky blue Baltic, money's the mainspring that makes it all tick. Like a blinkin' beacon, there's a price tag peekin' from each décolletage divine. Be she green or scarlet, even mom's a harlot. It's the good Lord's grand design. Eh, and it's sunny days for the black, black market, 'cause silver and gold make it shine. Harris and Otto joining in here on three-part harmony, while the idle and hungry of Swinemünde look on, white-faced as patient livestock. But their bodies are only implied. Wire racks for pre-war suits and frocks, too ancient, too glassy with dirt, with passage. Leaving the promenade, they pause at a street corner while a detachment of Russian infantry and horsemen marches by. "Gee, they're pouring in," notes Otto. "Where's the circus?"
"Up the coast, kid," says Nerisch.
"What's up the coast?" inquires Slothrop.
"Look out," warns Nerisch. "He's a spy."
"Don't call me kid," Otto snarls.
"Spy's ass," says Slothrop.
"He's all right," Springer pats them all on the shoulders. "Herr Gemütlich here. The word's been out on him for a while. He isn't even armed." To Slothrop. "You're welcome to come along with us up the coast. It might be interesting for you." But Slothrop is no dummy. He notices how he is getting funny looks from everybody now, including that Springer. Among the cargo headed up the coast are six chorus girls, wearing feathers and spangles under old cloth coats to save trunk space, a small pit band at different levels of alcoholic slumber, many, many cases of vodka, and a troop of performing chimpanzees. Otto's nautical, piratical mother has one of these chimps cornered inside the pilot house where they are going at it, the Frau with her insults, the chimp reaching now and then trying to slap her with his floppy banana peel. Ulcerous impresario GMB Haftung is trying to get Otto's attention. He has a record of always making his appeals to the wrong personnel.
That's Wolfgang in there. He'll murder her.
Wolfgang's his prized chimp. Somewhat unstable, does a fair Hitler imitation, but has this short attention span.
Well, vaguely, he'd better watch out for my mum.
Framed here in her lozenge of hatchway, it's much clearer just how extensively this old woman has been around. She is leaning, lifting, big sweet smile, just as toothy as can be, right into that Wolfgang, cooing at him,
Deine Mutter.
Say, she's never seen one of those critters before, Slothrop turning to Otto, surprising the youth with a face full of, call it, amiable homicide. Has she?
Ach, she's fantastic. She knows by instinct exactly how to insult anybody. Doesn't matter, animal, vegetable, I even saw her insult a rock once.
Ah, now,
really, yeah, a gigantic clump of felsitic debris last year off the coast of Denmark. She criticized its...
just about to fall into one of those mirthless laughs we edge away from.
It's crystalline structure for 20 minutes. Incredible.
Chorus girls have already pried open a case of vodka. Haftung, brushing hair that grows only in memory across the top of his head, rushes over to scream at them. Boys and girls, all ages, tattered and thin, trail across the brow, stevedoring. Against the fair sky, chimps swing from spars and antenna. Above them, seagulls glide by and stare. Wind rises. Soon a whitecap here and there will start to flicker out in the harbor. Each child carries a bale or box of a different shape, color, and size. Springer stands by, pince-nez clipped in front of agate eyes, checking off his inventory in a green Morocco book, snails and garlic sauce, one gross, 3 cases cognac, tennis balls, 2 dozen, 1 Victrola, film, Lucky Pierre runs amok, 3 reels, binoculars, 60, wristwatches, und so weiter, a check mark for each child. Presently, all has been stowed below decks. Chimps fall asleep. Musicians wake up. Girls surround Haftung and call him names and pinch his cheeks. Otto makes his way along the side, hauling in lines as the children cast them off. As the last one is flung away, its eye splice still in midair, framing a teardrop vista of gutted Sphinaminda, Frau Knopp, sensing the release from land through her feet, gets underway in the usual manner, nearly losing a chimp over the fantail and sending Haftung's half-dozen lovelies sprawling in a winsome tangle of legs, bottoms, and breasts. Cross-currents tug at the boat as it moves out the widening funnel of the Sphina toward the sea. Just inside the breakwaters, where it foams through breaches bombed underwater in the spring lookout, Frau Knab, with no change of expression, swings her wheel full over, goes barreling straight at the Sassnitz ferry, whoosh, veers away just in time, cackling at passengers staggering back from the rail, gaping after her.
"Please, Mother,"
silent Otto, plaintive in the window of the pilot house. In reply, the good woman commences bellowing a bloodthirsty sea shanty. I'm the pirate queen of the Baltic Run, and nobody fucks with me, and those who've tried are bones and skulls and lie beneath the sea, and the little fish like messengers swim in and out their eyes, singing fuck you not with gory knop and a desperate enterprise. I'll tangle with a battleship, I'll massacre a sloop, I've sent 100 souls to hell in one relentless swoop. I've seen the Flying Dutchman, and each time we pass he cries, oh steer me clear of gory knop and a desperate enterprise. Whereupon she grips her wheel and accelerates. They find themselves now leaping toward the side of a half-sunken merchantman. Black concave iron splashed with red lead, each crusted rivet and pitted plate closing in, looming over. The woman is clearly unbalanced. Slothrop shuts his eyes and hangs on to a chorus girl. With a whoop from the pilot house, the little boat is put over hard to port, missing collision by maybe a few coats of paint. Otto, caught daydreaming of death, staggers wildly by, heading over the side. It's her sense of humor, he points out on the way past. Slothrop reaches out, grabs him by the sweater, and the girl grabs Slothrop by the tail of his tuxedo. She gets into something a little illegal, Otto a moment later catching his breath. You see what happens. I don't know what to do with her. Poor kid, the girl smiles. Ah, says Otto. Slothrop leaves them, always happy to see young people get together, and joins Von Gerl and Nerisch on the fantail. Frau Knab has angled, wallowing, around to the northwest. Presently, they are heading up the coast through white-streaked, salt-smelling Baltic. Well, where are we going, fellas? Jovial Slothrop wants to know. Nerisch stares. That is the Isle of Usedom. Von Gerl explains gently. It is bounded on one side by the Baltic Sea. It is also bounded by two rivers. Their names are the Swine and the Peene. We were just on the Swine River. We were in Swinemünde. Swinemünde means mouth of the Swine River. All right, all right. We are headed around the island of Usedom to a place that is at the mouth of the Peene River. Let's see, so that would be called, wait, Peenemünde, right? Very good. So, there is a pause. Oh, that Peenemünde. Narish, as it turns out, used to work up there. He's apt to brood some at the idea of Russians occupying the place. There was a liquid oxygen plant I had my eye on, too. Springer, a little down with it himself. I wanted to start a chain. We're still angling for the one in Falkenrode at the old Goering Institute. There's a bunch of those LOX generators under Nordhausen, Slothrop trying to be helpful. Thanks, the Russians have that too, you'll recall. That's a problem. If it weren't so against nature, I'd say they don't know what they want. The roads heading east are jammed day and night with Russian lorries full of materiel, all kinds of loot, but no clear pattern to it yet beyond strip it and pack it home. Jeepers, clever Slothrop here. Do you reckon they've found that Escheret yet, huh, Mr. Van Gerl? Ah, cute, beams the Springer. He's an OSS man, groans Narish. Tell you, we ought to rub him out. Escheret's going for £10,000 these days, half of that in front. You interested? Nope, but I did hear at Nordhausen that you already have it. Wrong. Gerhardt, he's all right, Klaus. The look is one Slothrop's had before, from auto salesmen signaling their partners. Got a real idiot here, Leonard. Now don't spook him, please. We planted the story deliberately in Stettin, wanted to see how a Colonel Tcherny will respond. Fuck him again, he'll respond, all right. Well, that's what we're going up to Peenemünde today to find out. Oh, boy. Slothrop goes on to tell about the run-in at Potsdam and how Gailey thought Tcherny didn't care about rocket hardware nearly so much as working out some plot against that Oberst Enzium. If the two marketeers are interested, they don't show it. The talk has drifted on into that kind of slack, nameful recapitulating that Slothrop's mother and Aline loved to float away on in the afternoons. Helen Trent, Stella Dallas, Mary Noble, backstage wife. Tcherny is a complex man. It's almost as if he thinks of Enzian as another part of him, a black version of something inside himself, as something he needs to liquidate. Narish, do you think there might be some political reason? Von Gerl, shaking his head. I just don't know, Klaus, ever since what happened in Central Asia. Narish, you mean? Von Gerl, yes, the Kyrgyz light. You know, it's funny. He's never wanted to be thought of as an imperialist. Narish, none of them do, but there's the girl. Von Gerl, little gaily tripping, the one who thinks she's a witch. Narish, but do you really think she means to go through with this plan of hers to find Tcherny? Von Gerl, I think they do. Narish, but Gerhardt, he is in love with him. Von Gerl, he hasn't been dating her, has he? Narish, you can't be implying... Say, splutters Slothrop, what the heck are you guys talking about anyway? Paranoia, Springer snaps reproachfully, as folks will snap when interrupted at a game they enjoy. You wouldn't understand that. Well, excuse me, got to go vomit now. A classic comeback among charm school washouts like our tactful Tyrone here, and pretty advanced stuff on dry land, but not out here, where the Baltic is making it impossible not to be seasick. Chimps are all doing their vomiting, huddled under a tarp. Slothrop joins at the rail a miserable lot of musicians and girls. They instruct him in fine points, such as not vomiting into the wind, and timing it for when the ship rolls toward the sea, Frau Knob having expressed the hope that no one would get any vomit on her ship with the kind of glacial smile Dr. Mabuse used to get, especially on a good day. She can be heard in the pilot house now, bellowing her sea shanty. "Ooh," goes Slothrop over the side. And this is how their desperate enterprise goes a-rollicking up the coast of Usedom under a hazy summer sky. On shore, the green downs roll up in two gentle steps. Above them is a chain of hills, thick with pines and oaks. Little resort towns with white beaches and forlorn jetties wheel abeam rheumatically slow. Military-looking craft, probably Russian PT boats, will be seen now and then lying dead in the water. None challenge the Frau's passage. The sun is in and out, turning the decks of a stark moment's yellow around everyone's shadow. there's a late time of day when all shadows are thrown along the same east-northeast bearing as the test rockets were always fired out to sea from Peenemünde. The exact clock time, which varies through the year, is known as rocket noon. And the sound that must at that moment fill the air for its devout can only be compared with a noontime siren the whole town believes in, and guts resonate hard as stone. Before you sight it, you can feel the place. Even draped over a gunwale, cheek against a fender smelling of tar, eyes tearing and insides sloshing as the sea. Even barren and scorched as Rozakovsky and the White Russian army left it in the spring, it's a face. On the maps, it's a skull or a corroded face in profile facing southwest. A small marshy lake for the eye socket, nose and mouth cavity cutting in at the entrance to the Peene just below the power station. The draftsmanship is a little like a Wilhelm Busch cartoon face, some old fool for mischievous boys to play tricks on. Tapping his tanks for grain alcohol, scratching great naughty words across fields of his fresh cement, or even sneaking in to set off a rocket in the middle of the night. Low, burned-out buildings now. Ash images of camouflage nets burned onto the concrete. They had only a minute to glow like a burgher's silk mantle to light this coastal indoors, this engineer's parlor full of stodgy shapes and neutral tones. Didn't it only flare? No need to put right, nothing monitory, no new levels to be reached. But who would that be, watching so civil and mild over the model top? Face all in these chromo sunset colors, eyes inside black rim lenses which, like the flaring nets now, are seen to have served as camouflage for who but the bicycle rider in the sky, the black and fatal Edwardian silhouette on the luminous breast of sky of today's rocket noon, two circular explosions inside the rush hour in the death scene of the sky's light. How the rider twirls up there, terminal and serene. In the tarot he is known as the Fool, but around the zone here they call him Slick. It's 1945. Still early, still innocent. Some of it is. Charred, helpless latticework. What was wooden now only settles without strength. Green human shapes flash in the ruins. The scale is very confusing along here. The troops look larger than they should. A zoo? A shooting gallery? Why, some of both. Frau Knob wallows in closer to land, proceeds up the marshy shoreline at half speed. Signs of occupation increase. Lorry parks, tents, a corral teeming with horses, pied, sorrel, snow-white, red as blood. Wild summer ducks up exploding, wet and showery, out of green reeds. They swing aft over the boat and descend in its wake, where they bob quacking in two-foot excursions. High in the sunlight, a white-tailed eagle is soaring. Smooth-lipped bomb and shell craters hold blue seawater. Barracks have had their roofs blown away, spinal and ribwise and sun-white, the bones of these creatures that must have held in their time half the Jonahs of falling Europe. But trees, beech and pine, have begun to grow in again where spaces were cleared and leveled for housing or offices, up through cracks in the pavement, everywhere life may gain purchase, up rushes green summer 45, and the forests are still growing dense on the upland. Passing now the great blackened remains of the development works, most of it strewn at ground level. In series, some ripped and broken, others largely hidden by the dunes, Narish reverently telling them one by one, come the concrete masses of the test stands, stationed to the cross, Roman numerals 6, 5, 3, 4, 2, 9, 8, 1, finally the rocket own, from which it stood and flew at last, 7 and 10. Trees that once screened these from the sea now are only stalks of charcoal. Pulling around the northern curve of the peninsula, test stand wall and earthworks receding, moving now past Peenemünde West, the Luftwaffe's old territory. Far away to starboard, the cliffs of the Greifswalder Oie shimmer through the blue haze. Concrete launching ramps used to test the V-1 or buzz bomb point at the sea. Runways pocked with craters, heaped with rubble and wrecked Messerschmitts swing by down the peninsula. Over the Skull's Arc, south again toward the Peene, there, above the rolling hills, miles off the port bow, the red brick tower of the cathedral in Volgast. And closer in, the half-dozen stacks of the power station, smokeless over Peenemünde, have survived the lethal compression loads of March. White swans drift in the reeds, and pheasants fly over the tall pines inland. A truck motor snarls somewhere into life. Frau Knab brings her boat around in a tight turn through an inlet to the dock. The summer calm lies over everything, rolling stock inert on its tracks. One soldier sitting against an orange-topped oil drum trying to play an accordion, maybe only fooling around. Otto lets go of his chorus girl's hand, his mother cuts the engines, and he steps broadly to the dock and jogs along, making fast. Then there's a brief pause. Diesel fumes, marsh birds, quiet idleness. Somebody's staff car racketing around the corner of a cargo shed slides to a stop, bouncing forth out of its rear door a major even fatter than Duane Marvey, but with a kindlier and dimly oriental face. Gray hair like sheep's wool comes twisting down all around his head. Ah, Pangol! Arms outstretched, wrinkled eyes shiny with... is it real tears? Pangol, my dear friend! Major Zhdaev! Springer nods, ambling over the brow, as behind the major now this truckload of troops and fatigues seems to be pulling up here. Kind of odd they should be toting those submachine guns and carbines just for some stevedoring. Right, before anyone can move, they've leaped out and made a cordon around Zhdaev and the Springer pieces at the ready. Do not be alarmed, Zhdaev, waving and beaming, strolling backward to the car with his arm around the Springer. We are detaining your friend for a bit. You may proceed with your work and go. We'll see that he gets safely back to Swinemünde. What the devil? Frau Knab comes growling out of the pilot house. Haftung shows up, twitching, putting hands in various pockets and taking them out again. Who are they arresting? What about my contract? Will anything happen to us? The staff car pulls away. Enlisted men begin filing on board. Shit, ponders Nerish. You think it's a bust? I think Tchernyi is responding with interest, just as you said. Oh, now. No, no, hand on sleeve. He's right, you're harmless. Thanks. I warned him, but he laughed. Another leap, Nerish. I have to keep leaping, don't I? Well, what do you want to do now, cut him loose? There is some excitement amidships. The Russians have thrown back a tarp to reveal the chimps, who are covered with vomit and have also broken into the vodka. Haftung blinks and shudders. Wolfgang is on his back, sucking at a gurgling bottle he is clutching with his feet. Some of the chimps are docile, others are looking for a fight. Somehow, Slothrop does wish the man would quit talking this way, I owe him that much. Well, I don't, Slothrop dodging a sudden plume of yellow chimpanzee vomit. He ought to be able to take care of himself. His talk's grandiose enough, but he's not paranoid in his heart. In this line of work, that's a disaster. One of the chimps now bites a Soviet corporal in the leg. The corporal screams, unslinging his Tokayev and firing from the hip, by which time the chimp has leaped for a halyard. A dozen more of the critters, many carrying vodka bottles, head en masse for the gangplank. Don't let them get away, Haftung hollers. The trombone player sticks his head sleepily out a hatch to ask what's happening and has his face walked over by three sets of pink-soled feet before grasping the situation. Girls, spangles aflame in the afternoon sun, feathers all quivering, are being chased forward and aft by drooling Red Army personnel. Frau Knab pulls on her steam whistle, thereby spooking the rest of the chimps who join the stampede to shore. Catch them, Haftung pleads. Somebody! Slothrop finds himself between Otto and Nerish, being pushed ashore over the brow by soldiers chasing after chimps or girls or trying to wrangle the cargo ashore. Among splashes, cursing, and girlish shrieks from the other side of the boat, chorus girls and musicians keep appearing and wandering back and forth. It is difficult to perceive just what the fuck is happening here. Listen, Frau Knab leaning over the side. Trothrop notices a canny squint. You have a plan? You want to pull a diversionary feint? What, what? Chimps, musicians, dancing girls, decoys all over, while the three of you sneak in and grab their Springer. We can hide, Nerish looking around gangster-eyed. Nobody'll notice. Yeah, yeah, the boat can take off, as if we were on board. Not me, says Slothrop. Aha, says Frau Knab. Aha, says Nerish. I'll lie, too, at the northeast corner, this mad mother continues, in the channel between the little island and that triangular part that's built up on the foreshore. Test stand X. Catchy name. I think here'll be enough of a tide by then. Light a fire, Otto. Cast me off now. Zu befehl, Mutti. Slothrop and Nerish go dash behind a cargo shed, find a boxcar, and hide inside. Nobody notices. Chimps are running by in several directions. The soldiers chasing them seem by now to be really pissed off. Someplace the clarinet player is blowing scales on his instrument. The boat's motor sputters up into a growl and screws go churning away. A while later, Otto and his girl come climb in the boxcar out of breath. Well, Nerish, Slothrop might as well ask, Where'd they take him, do you think, eh? From what I could see, Block 4 and that whole complex to the south were deserted. My guess is the assembly building near Test Stand 7. Under that big ellipse, there are underground tunnels and rooms ideal for a headquarters. Looks like most of it survived pretty well, even though Rosokovsky had orders to level the place. You got a piece? Neris shakes his head. No. Me neither. What kind of black market operator are you anyway? No piece. I used to be in inertial guidance. You expect me to revert? Well, what are we supposed to use then, our wits? Out the slats of the car, the sky is darkening, the clouds turning orange, tangerine, tropical. Otto and his girl are murmuring in one corner. Scrub that one, Neris with sour mouth. 5 minutes away from his mother, he's a Casanova. Otto was earnestly explaining his views on the mother conspiracy. It's not often a sympathetic girl will listen. The mothers get together once a year in secret at these giant conventions and exchange information, recipes, games, key phrases to use on their children. What did yours used to say when she wanted to make you feel guilty? I've worked my fingers to the bone, says the girl. Right, and she used to cook those horrible casseroles with the potatoes and onions and ham, little piece of ham. You see, that can't be accidental. They have a contest for Mother of the Year, breastfeeding, diaper changing. They time them, casserole competitions, yeah. Then, toward the end, they actually begin to use the children. The state prosecutor comes out on stage. In a moment, Albrecht, we are going to bring your mother on. Here is a Luger fully loaded. The state will guarantee you absolute immunity from prosecution. Do whatever you wish to do, anything at all. Good luck, my boy. The pistols are loaded with blanks, natürlich, but the unfortunate child does not know this. End of side 16. Change side's electric switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.